Peter Wieringa presented his intellectual autobiography as the seventh talk in a series entitled Coming to Truth on February 20th, 2008 at McKinsey Study Center's Wednesday night class. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2008. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
All right. Well, let's go ahead and get started. This is a makes for a very interesting exercise to go through and to prepare for something like this. Very interesting. Just thinking through sort of start to finish my life and the different influences on my life spiritually, intellectually, been very interesting. Even to the point of over the course of my preparation, I started thinking about some of my old college professors, and I got out some of my notes from college. I actually sent an email off to one of my college professors from 30 years ago. Let's see, 72, 36 years ago. It's been very fun, very, very interesting working on this. So I'm going to just go through for you in probably more detail than perhaps you want, but I'm going to go through for you in great detail just what my life experiences have been, the influences on my life, the things that have developed my thinking. And even as I was preparing to do that, my story, and you have heard this probably from some of the others, I'm not sure my story is all that interesting. I mean, it's interesting to me because I lived it and because it's so very familiar to me. But there weren't any great revelations. There weren't any things that happened in my life. I was going to say not any things that were earth-shaking. That's probably not altogether true, but like I said, it's just been interesting going through this exercise. I'm going to go way, way back, and I'm going to start off talking about some of the influences when I was very young, because for me, I don't view my life as having at any point radically changed directions. I was on a course at a fairly young age, and I don't feel as though at any point I strayed particularly far from that course. And a lot of that, I think, has to do with the background that I grew up in. It has to do with the family that I grew up in, the experiences that I had growing up. I grew up in the Midwest. I was actually born in Denver, Colorado. Lived in Denver for 7 years, but the most formative years I can think of were the years I spent in Pella, Iowa. I do have memories going all the way back to Denver. My father was a pastor. Now, for any of you, are any of you familiar with the term PK and all of the connotations that go along with being a PK? Are there any other PKs in our... That is a PK is a preacher's kid, and in the Midwest, that has very clear and definite connotations that go along with it. But my earliest memories of living in Denver, well, I had a couple of memories. The first was one of the earliest ones was learning about motorcycles and learning that motorcycles ran on orange peels. I don't know who told me that. Fortunately, I never had a motorcycle to try that out with, but that was one of my earliest memories. Another was standing on the front yard of our lawn at our house. In those days, the church, the parsonage, the house that the pastor's family lived in was right next to the church that my dad pastored. And I remember standing on the front lawn of the parsonage, practicing casting with my new Zebco ZB, which was a kid's fishing rod. And I remember practicing casting with my older brother, 2 years older than me, as we argued over which one of us was going to pastor the church when my father passed away. Those are some of my very earliest memories of growing up. Now, my father was a pastor in the Reformed Church in America. Now, that probably doesn't mean anything to most of you folks, but I got to tell you, the Reformed Church in America was the first denomination established on the North American continent. That's its primary claim to fame. In New Amsterdam, it's some people refer to it as the Dutch Reformed Church. There was actually a church that was started in New Amsterdam in 1628 that is still, not the same building obviously, but the same congregation is still meeting. That was the first, they're really old at this point, that was the first congregation established and the first denomination established. Well, needless to say, growing up in the Reformed Church in America, there is a lot of tradition. And growing up the son of a pastor in the Reformed Church, growing up a PK, lots of tradition, lots of expectations that went along with that. Now, that wasn't too big a deal when we were out in Denver, because Denver was out in the wild, wild west. The Dutch were all settled in Michigan, in New York, New Jersey, in Iowa. That's where there are a bunch of them up in Canada, but Colorado was the Wild West, and so there weren't quite the same expectations out there. But we went from, my father planted a church in Denver, brand new church, so we went from that church to a church. We moved in 1961 to Pella, Iowa, where my dad pastored a church that was about to celebrate its 100th anniversary. He was the pastor of Second Reformed Church, which was across the street and 100 yards away from First Reformed Church, both of which were about 100 yards away from Third Reformed Church. And then they got really creative, and Trinity Reformed Church was about 3 blocks away. But this was a Dutch town. Oh, and that's just the Reformed churches. Then there were the Christian Reformed churches, the Offiskite, as they were known. We referred to them affectionately as the Offies when we were growing up. The Christian Reformed Church was a denomination that had split off from the Reformed Church 100 years earlier. We all, as far as I know, thought basically the same things, did basically the same things, but there was some difference somewhere back 100 years earlier that caused the two to split. But in this little town, 5,000 people, everybody's Dutch. Everybody is either in the Reformed Church or the Christian Reformed Church, except there was one Baptist church. We didn't know any Baptists ourselves. And there was one Catholic church. But other than that, basically a very homogenous group of people. And it was just a very interesting experience. A lot of, let me tell you a little bit more about the Reformed Church in America. Interesting mix. The denomination was an interesting mix of conservative and somewhat liberal tendencies. The Reformed Church in America was one of the founding denominations of the National Council of Churches and the World Council of Churches. If you were active in denominations in the 60s, if you were active in conservative churches or Bible churches, the National Council of Churches, the World Council of Churches, they were like of the devil. I mean, they were the liberal organizations, liberal in their theology, liberal in much of their practice. The Reformed Church helped to start those two organizations, but at the same time had some very conservative trends. And it's been interesting over the years to think about where my father stood on all those things, to think about other relatives. I actually had an uncle in Grand Rapids. My dad told me about him some 10 years ago, an uncle in Grand Rapids who got tossed out of the Reformed Church for his very conservative views. I mean, just just some interesting history in the church over the years. My father and mother, I have no doubt in my mind, but that they were sincere believers. Just absolutely no question about it. It was interesting. It was kind of sad, actually, but very interesting when I was much older, when I was in my 30s, and I was on the pastoral staff of a church over in Boise. One of my responsibilities was to help set up pastors' conferences, and my dad would attend some of those pastors' conferences from time to time. And we actually had some of the folks from the pastoral staff. Ray Stedman from the pastoral staff at Peninsula Bible Church came up and did some of the conferences and others. And my father remarked, this is after he had retired, and he remarked somewhat wistfully that he wished he had gotten some of this training when he was in seminary, because when he went to seminary, they didn't teach the seminarians to teach the Bible. They taught them to give topical sermons. Topical sermon would basically be pick a verse and construct your thesis and the point that you wanted to make around that verse, and whether you're speaking and whether your verse necessarily coincided wasn't the big issue. The point was, if you have something to say, you say it, and you find a verse that fits in with it. Well, it was like I said, sad years and years later when my father commented after being exposed to some Bible teachers, he commented about how he wished he had had that exposure much earlier. But I do remember that growing up in the Reformed Church, I do remember very distinctly that I felt as though my dad and the church that he pastored did things a little bit unorthodoxly, in a little bit of an unorthodox manner. I had the clear impression that he marched to the beat of a little bit different drummer than did the rest of the denomination. Fairly early on, we started using the Revised Standard Version. I don't know, some of you guys are so young that this doesn't mean anything to you, but the Revised Standard Version was one of the earlier modern translations in America that took hold. Prior to that time, most folks were using the King James Version. There had been some earlier, well, all along there had been translations, but this was one of the better translations that used contemporary English that actually caught on. And we used that. I remember my dad using that at our church, and that somehow or other I understood that in the Reformed Church in America, that was just a little bit radical. That was just a little bit edgy to do something like that. Likewise, I remember with the high school, the junior high, the high school groups, they had a lot more leeway in the congregation than many folks would perhaps have thought they should. I remember that there were times that they put on skits and or plays, not just like on a Wednesday evening or on a Sunday evening or something like that, but in place of the worship service on Sunday morning. All things that some of the older Dutch women in the congregation frowned upon, but I have the distinct impression, and this is actually important to me, I have the distinct impression that my father didn't care to do things simply because everybody else in the church, everybody else in the denomination were doing things that way. And for me, then, that was absolutely a part of who I was growing up, understanding that simply because things were done a certain way in the church, in the denomination, in the church at large, that was not necessarily the reason to continue doing things that way. Another just a little personal note. Again, as a PK, there were very definitely expectations that were upon us as preachers' kids. And I remember when one of the prominent church families. One of the older women who was a part of one of the very prominent families in the church complained to my mother about the behavior of her children. That would be me that she was that she was complaining about. Although I did have five brothers and sisters, so it. I'm sure I had partners in crime, but I remember very distinctly. I don't remember what my mother said. I wasn't there at the time, but I remember very distinctly my mother basically communicating that this was none of this woman's business, that this woman was not to tell her how to raise her children, and that she was quite honestly quite happy with her children. All of that is to say, and I do believe that this factors into my intellectual and spiritual development because, well, my home, my family, was a very safe place to be. My parents thought that we kids, the six of us, they thought we were great. They thought that we were interesting, that we were fun. They were unbelievably supportive of us. I don't think that there was anything that I did growing up, whether it was a sporting event, and when you grow up in a little town in Iowa, our junior high had 200 kids, 100 kids in the 7th grade, 100 kids in the 8th grade. So you grew up in a school like that. I played on every sports team. Not well, but I played on them. I was in four of the singing groups that the school had. I played in the band. I was in the school play. I mean, in a school that size, you do everything. And my father was there for everything. I can remember very distinctly just how unbelievably supportive he was, and I have very fond memories of. For a time, we lived right next to the church there. Also, the parsonage was right next to the church, and I remember very fondly going out the back door, walking 20 feet next door to the church building, going up into my dad's office when he was in there studying. And curling up in a chair in his study and the book that I pulled off of his chair was the collection of Reader's Digest jokes. So I don't want you to think that I was reading theology or anything like that, but I'd sit very, very happily for long periods of time there, just being around my dad. So again, I think that's important for me. It obviously is important to me because. And I'm not sure exactly how to express it, but I have the impression that it was a lot easier for me to come to some understanding of God as Father because of the relationship I had with my own father and mother. It was not, at no point in my life, was I rebellious against my parents? I mean, certainly there were some times that I thought they were out to lunch, old-fashioned, that sort of thing, but at no point did I radically rebel. They were unbelievably supportive of me, and so for me, it seems as though sometimes there's a correlation between how one relates to God and even relates to the church based on some of their own relationships when they're a lot younger. Well, for me, my relationships as I was a lot younger were just tremendous, just outstanding. So that was in Pella, lived there from the time I was 7 till the time I was 14. Another very vivid memory for me during that time, and it's right along the lines of the other things that I've talked about. Another very vivid memory was when the church brought in copies of a translation of the Bible known as Good News for Modern Man. It's now known as Today's English Version. It's actually It was one of the earlier translations. I always thought of it as a paraphrase. They claimed to be to have been a translation that translated the thoughts and the ideas, a dynamic equivalent translation, rather than a word for word, more literal translation. But I remember when the Good News for Modern Man was first published, 1966, 67, something like that, showed up in our church. I'm sure my dad, it wouldn't have been there if it didn't have his approval, showed up in our church. I picked it up, and I don't know if any of you, it'd have to be you older folks, remember seeing that version when it came out, complete with stick figures. I mean, my King James version of the Bible, you would open up and you'd have these color plates with everybody had halos and everybody, you know, looked great and was well manicured and all that sort of thing. Well, Good News for Modern Man, stick figures illustrating the parables and all that sort of thing. Well, I picked up a Good News for Modern Man one time, and I remember reading it for hours and hours and hours one evening at home. I'd never been interested in reading the Bible. I mean, I grew up a PK. I was around that sort of thing all the time. I felt absolutely no need or even interest particularly to do that sort of thing on my own initiative, but I picked that up and just read it voraciously for a couple of days and understood it. That was just a critical experience for me. And the other, before we leave Pella, the other very clear experience that I remember was sitting in church one day, and for all the sermons that my father preached, I'm not sure I remember one of them. I mean, that's the reality of it. I don't know if he was particularly eloquent or not. I know that his sermons influenced me, obviously, but I didn't pay a whole lot of attention when I was that age. But I very distinctly remember one time sitting in church, and I was doing my usual daydreaming thing. Had all sorts of creative ways to daydream. And I remember, I don't remember exactly what my father was talking about, but it had something to do with the gospel, had something to do with the whole idea of salvation. And I just remember as clear as could be sitting there and thinking through in my own mind the conviction, absolute conviction, that God was the answer to all of the ills and problems of the world, and that everyone in the world needed God, except me. I mean, it was just as clear as could be that I sat there thinking, now I seem to, in my own mind, I thought I really have it together pretty well. I do well in school. Like I said, in a junior high of 200, it's easy to stand out in a school like that, but did well in school, had a lot of friends, all that sort of thing. So it was just as clear as could be to me that, yes, there is something to be said about the truth of Christianity. I mean, in my mind, that was just a given. But in terms of it being applicable to me, or in terms of it being something that would make a difference in my life, I was absolutely clear that I didn't need it. I was perfectly self-sufficient. I was perfectly able to get by on my own. That was the conviction I had. That was probably, I'd say probably 7th grade, 8th grade, something like that. But that was just, that's just the most vivid memory. Well, then from there, we moved from Pella, Iowa, town of 5,000, right after I finished the 8th grade, that summer, we moved to Southern California. Now, if ever there was a shock to the system, it would be moving from Pella, Iowa, to Southern California. I think of Southern California as being sort of the antimatter to Pella, Iowa. I don't even know what antimatter is, but that sounds good. It was the strangest thing. In Southern California, the very clothes that you wore were the opposite of the ones that you were supposed to wear in Pella. The music you listened to was opposite the music you listened to in Pella. I mean, just right down the line, who I was as a person that in Pella was so acceptable was completely unacceptable in Southern California. I didn't know this happened, but yes, people do ridicule you, young people, other freshmen in high school do ridicule you for the clothes you're wearing, if the clothes you're wearing don't fit in with their expectations. It was a shock to my system. I mean, absolutely a shock. Going from being a relatively big fish in a very small pond, the high school that I went to in Southern California had 2,000 students. So I went from a class of 100 students to a class of 500. And what I did very promptly, very quickly, was went to my room and sank into a deep depression. And for a year, for my freshman year, I spent virtually all of my time in my room in a very deep depression. Now, I didn't recognize it at the time. It seemed to me as though my response was a perfectly reasonable, perfectly understandable response to what was going on. But my sister tells me later, she's told me over the years that she's 2 years younger than I was, she and my parents were quite worried about me because I did nothing. I would come home from school. This is the kid who did everything when I was growing up. Well, now I did absolutely nothing. Come home from school and just went into my room. Very, very interesting experience at the same time. We moved out to Southern California. My father was no longer a pastor in the Reformed Church. He was now, he was referred to as a field secretary. His job was to help plant churches out in the West. So he had an administrative position. He wasn't pastoring the church anymore. But the church we attended, that we began to go to as soon as we got out there, was the Crystal Cathedral. I'm looking around for anybody who recognizes what that's all about. The Crystal Cathedral, for those of you who aren't familiar with it, before it was the Crystal Cathedral, it was just plain old Garden Grove Community Church. Garden Grove Community Church was the first drive-in church. I heard that from the back row there. I heard that. The first drive-in church in Southern California, where nobody likes to get out of their car. What better thing to do than to have a church at a drive-in? So the pastor of the church, Robert Schuller, the pastor of the church in 1954, started a church at the local drive-in. He stood on top of the snack bar and preached, and people pulled up, and he had a microphone, and they put the little thing in the window of their car, and they listened to him in their car, and that was how they went to church. And then they built a church that basically was set up as a drive-in theater, but with an inside auditorium as well. So you could either sit inside, or you could just drive up, and they had these, the building was huge, and they had these huge glass doors that would open so that if you were sitting out in the car, he could step out onto the balcony, you could hear him and see him out in the car as well as from inside the auditorium. It was a radical, well, not necessarily in a good way, but it was a complete change from what church was like in those days. The goal was to bring in people who wouldn't go to church otherwise. Garden Grove Community Church was also a Reformed church. Bob Schuller was the proponent of the power of possibility thinking, as opposed to Norman Vincent Peale, who was the proponent of the power of positive thinking. He was also in the Reformed Church in America. All these distinctions that I have as part of my heritage here. But what was interesting was here I am at Garden Grove Community Church, and contrary to what a lot of people think about the church, I remember when I was in college, it was sort of cool to make fun of the church when we were away from it because of a lot of the idiosyncrasies. But I remember at times rising to the defense of the church because, indeed, Bob Schuller got people into the church that wouldn't have come otherwise. And there were a number of other pastors on the staff who were actually gifted Bible teachers. And so there was a whole program that went on behind the scenes, that went on during the week, Sunday evenings, that sort of thing, that actually offered some very good biblical instruction that was quite outside of the public view. Well, the high school group was an extremely active high school group. The high school pastor was somebody who was very familiar with the folks you've, over the last couple weeks, you've heard from I think, Jack, you've spoken already, haven't you? We missed that one, but you've heard from Jack, Ron, David. Those guys all talked at least a little bit about their experiences at Peninsula Bible Church. Well, the high school pastor had been heavily influenced by what was going on up at Peninsula Bible Church. So here we had at this drive-in church, this interesting church down here, I grew up in a high school group that actually had some very, very good biblical teaching. But I was still very much out of my element there. The first year that I was in the high school group, I went only because I had to. I really had no interest in being there. I would sit in the back of the room, not pay much attention to what was going on, just did not want to be there for the most part. But then summer after my freshman year, the high school group was going off to camp. They were going to camp at Mount Hermon, which is up in Northern California. Just before they went off to camp, if I remember correctly, it was literally an hour or two before they went off to camp, somebody got the wild idea that I should go with them. I had no interest in going with them, but that I should go with them. So somehow or other, I ended up on the bus with enough clothes to get through the week. Went up to Mount Hermon, where we went to the high school camp. The first year, there was a high school camp that had just opened at Mount Hermon. The conference center had a main conference ground for family camps. It had a high school camp. It had a kids' camp. And going to the high school camp, Mount Hermon was heavily influenced by the sort of conservative Bible church movement that's the phrase that I use, that I came to be a part of. Peninsula Bible Church was very influential with the folks at Mount Hermon. The high school camp that I went to focused on biblical teaching. And it's hard, probably hard for a lot of you to put yourself in that time. That was the summer of 1969 when the Jesus movement was just coming into its own. And so, being at this high school camp, we had musicians there. John Fisher, whom Jack has known for years. John Fisher was the music pastor, or the music staff guy at Ponderosa Lodge. He was there for the whole summer. Other musicians came in, and I was exposed to a look at Christianity that was different from, far more interesting than what I had been exposed to before. So I had that experience when I was a freshman in high school, came back from camp, and a funny thing had happened in the meantime. My older brother, whom I haven't introduced to you yet, my older brother, 2 years older than me, had gone to another high school camp. He had gone to a counselor training camp at the same time. My older brother, as I was growing up, he and I were best friends. I mean, best friends. He let me tag along with him everywhere when we were growing up. When I was 8 years old and he was 10, he didn't mind letting me tag along with his friends to do the things that they were doing. When we left Iowa, we went west to California. He went east and actually was enrolled in a prep school in Massachusetts for his last 2 years of high school. So I only saw him on vacations, summertime, that sort of thing. But he had come back, gone to this counselor training camp, and I had this very strange experience after he got back. We got back the week before they did. His camp was 2 weeks long, and this very strange experience, because after he got back from the camp, a couple of very odd things happened. One was for Christmas, for my birthday, things like that, he began to give me gifts like Bibles, Bible dictionaries, concordances, commentaries, things like that. I always thought that was just like the weirdest possible gift. It reflected for him a tremendous interest in the scriptures that he had not really experienced prior to that time. But those were the gifts that he gave to me. The thing, though, that was the strangest of all was when one day he referred to God by his first name, Jesus. I mean, that shocked the daylights out of me. He talked about, this I'm sure sounds very odd to all of you folks, but he talked about Jesus in the first person. And when I grew up, it was God the Father, it was the Lord. It was some much more formal sort of title, but he talked about God, talked about Jesus in a much more familiar way. And to me, that was just weird. I just didn't quite understand what was going on there. But, and this is a theme I think you've heard from some of the other folks that have shared their experiences as well, there was no getting around the change in his life. Now, that's a little bit hard to say, because even prior to that time, he was like the greatest guy in the world. I mean, he was just a great kid, just a wonderful guy. But after that, you could just tell that there was a difference in how he did things, how he thought about things, how he approached life. There's just a difference there that was striking. So that all went on after my freshman year in high school. My sophomore year, summer after my sophomore year. Oh, the other funny thing, just odd thing that was going on. I was still attending Garden Grove Community Church. One of the pastor's sons, one of the associate pastor's sons, went to the same high school that I did. Very strange that my sophomore year, that when we would go to church and we were in the youth group, in fact, he would often come to my house and pick me up and drive me to the youth group because he had a car. When we were at the youth group, we were just best buddies. I mean, we were hanging out together. We were spending a lot of time together. But when we were back in the high school, he had nothing to do with me. He had grown up in the community. He was the guy in that school who was the great athlete, very popular, well known by everybody. And it was the strangest thing, because we would walk by each other in the hallway at the high school with little more than a nod. I mean, barely a nod of acknowledgement. But when we were in the high school group, we were best buddies along with everybody else in the group. And I'm sure that warped me for life. But anyway, I continued to go to Garden Grove Community Church. The summer after my sophomore year, I went to Arrowhead Springs, which is Campus Crusade for Christ. I went to a high school camp there. It was interesting. It was funny hearing from David last week about his experiences with Campus Crusade for Christ. There were some similarities with my experiences. We went to this camp, and the whole goal of the camp, there was a lot of teaching, but the primary goal of the camp was to train us in evangelism, to train us how to use the four spiritual laws, to train us how to go down to the beach, use the same surveys that David was talking about. That was the goal of the high school program there. And none of that caught my interest very much. What did catch my interest, and this is an aside, what did catch my interest at the camp was the teaching that was beginning to be sensationalized about the time, that time. A lot of the late great Planet Earth teaching, Hal Lindsey, that sort of thing. And there was a lot of talk about whether or not JFK was the Antichrist. And that was interesting. So we're going through that while we're at the camp. But the thing that jumps out from that experience for me was remembering one afternoon, I was actually at the camp because my cousin, my favorite cousin from Michigan, had come out to go to the camp. She had likewise grown up in the Reformed Church. She had the firm conviction, even at that point, the firm conviction that if in fact God was sovereign, if in fact God had anything to do with choosing those whom he would save, that she most certainly was not one of the chosen. I'm guessing that probably she was sent out to the camp as sort of a last ditch, let's try to get her back on track sort of thing. But the whole time we're at the camp, she had absolutely no interest in the content, just didn't mean anything to her. But I can remember for myself, one afternoon while I'm at the camp, and remember we're learning all this about how to do evangelism, about how to share the four spiritual laws, all that sort of thing. And I can remember at one point just kind of stopping and saying to myself, saying, okay, I think that I'm a Christian. I think I have been for a while. I believe this stuff. This stuff resonates with me. But let's just make it official. And it was a very conscious decision at that point. Let's just make sure we've got our bases covered. Let's just make it official. And on this day, and I actually remember the day for years. I can't remember. It was in the summer. But on this day, I wanted to affirm the fact that yes, I'm a believer. Now nothing changed. I hadn't been a hellraiser before I became a Christian. I wasn't a hellraiser after I became a Christian. I didn't wander away after I became a Christian. For me, it was just a fairly steady, reasonable series of relationships and influences that little by little over time got me to the point that I'm at now. Well, that was the summer after my sophomore year, summer after my junior year, back to Mount Hermon for the same camp that my brother had gone to 2 years earlier. And that camp was very influential for me. It was very influential because it combined some of the things that I like best. The camp was made up of, there were just 24 of us that were in the camp, 2 weeks together, very intense. It was a very intense time of personal interaction. And I'm the kind of person who likes to be around other people. I know that comes as a surprise to some of you, but I like being around other people. And so that experience for me was great. It was outstanding. I loved it because it was a time of getting to know other people. I mean, they were all the same age I was, basically, within a year or two. But getting to know a lot of other people on a very intimate level, at least as intimate as juniors and seniors in high school can get to know each other. So it combined that sense of community. And in fact, I kept in touch with some of the people that were part of that for the next decade or so. I mean, we formed some very close relationships there. It combined that along with a very heavy emphasis on biblical studies. Now, this is the point at which I bring in another huge influence in my life that I sometimes am not sure exactly how I should think about it. When we were at the camp, one of the things that we were taught was the importance of having quiet times. Now that, again, is a phrase that's familiar to some of you, perhaps not to others, but the whole idea was that it was critically important for us, we were taught, to make sure that we read and studied our Bible every single day. And so for me, there began my senior year a discipline. I actually got up like at 5:30, 6 in the morning to spend a half an hour reading my Bible. Now, what I'm not exactly sure how to think about is the fact that I never resented doing that. For me, that was a tremendous experience. Now, over the years, to be sure, I don't want to minimize this, to be sure, there were times that I got confused about how important that was. There were times that I thought, you know, if only I was having my quiet time more regularly, then there would be some other significant thing that would happen in my spiritual life. There were times that I got confused about those things. There were times, I'm sure, that I got confused about what that meant to God, about whether or not that was important to God. I'm sure I got confused about those things at times. But for me, the biggest impression, the biggest result of that time was I came to absolutely delight in reading and studying the Bible. I had a routine that I followed for a long, long time, for probably 10, 15, 20 years. I would read one psalm every day. I would read one chapter out of Proverbs every day. I would read a chapter out of the Old Testament, chapter out of the New Testament. The chapters out of the Old Testament and the New Testament were interesting for me because they gave me a feel for the flow of history and ideas in the Old Testament, and then gave me a feel for the life of Jesus and for the ideas that were expressed in the New Testament. So they were very important for just familiarizing me with the text, with what was going on there. But for me, what was most important was reading the Psalms and reading the Proverbs. And I think, I've tried to reconstruct why that is, I think reading the Psalms was important for me because I got a sense of how truly, profoundly understanding of human nature and of who God is were the writers of the Psalms. I would read the Psalms and they just rang true with me. I would read the Psalms and I would be encouraged by the Psalms. I would think about them a lot. I was always horrible at memorizing, so I was not a memorizer at all. But you read, if you read the Psalms one at a time, over the course of 5 months, you've read all of the Psalms. You start again. You do that for 5-10 years, and you get pretty familiar with them after a while. And for me, they were comforting. They were sometimes alarming. They were sometimes unexpected. But they were always tremendously insightful for me into human nature. Likewise, the book of Proverbs. You read Proverbs, and in some respects, it just seems like a whole bunch of disjointed ideas thrown together, and in some respects, that's perhaps exactly what they are. But, man, do they ring true. So, for me, the experience of having that discipline, if you will, of having a quiet time regularly, wasn't anything I ever resented, wasn't ever anything I rebelled against. I don't do it much anymore, or virtually at all, quite honestly. But what it did for me was it just gave me a familiarity with what the Bible had to say that convinced me, I think at this point I would say, in many respects, intuitively almost, of the truth of what the Scriptures had to say. Because I would read them, and it was clear that they were talking about me. They were talking about life. They were talking about the human experience, the human condition. It was clear that they were true. I mean, it just seemed clear to me. I didn't, as I've heard some of the other speakers the last couple weeks, at no point in my life did I struggle with whether or not the Bible was true. And I think probably a lot of that has to do with simply having so much familiarity with it from a fairly early age. I mean, going back to picking up the Good News for Modern Man when I was in seventh or eighth grade and just devouring it. I mean, just reading it voraciously because it was so interesting. I think that that familiarity built into me somewhere along the way just a comfort or a comfortability, if you will, with the idea that this is true. I didn't ever struggle with that. So that describes how things went through high school for me. Again, that experience, I am a little bit conflicted as to how to think about quiet times. I know that when my kids were growing up, I really wanted them to get in the habit of having quiet times. And for me, I think I was clear enough while they were growing up. I think I was really quite clear in communicating to them that whether or not they had their quiet times had nothing to do with their relationship with God, had nothing to do with whether or not they were saved, had nothing to do with righteousness or anything like that. It was simply a good habit, and that was because it had been so meaningful to me. Well, I think I did such a good job of convincing the kids that it had nothing to do with righteousness so that none of them ever got in the habit of having quiet times. but for me, I still sometimes have to stop and work that through, exactly where how important is something like that in the life of a believer. But anyway, moving on to college. Just a very interesting experiences when I went off to college. I had intended to be a math major. When I was in high school, I loved math. I loved Latin because for math, I mean, I loved it because there's a right answer and there's a wrong answer. No gray areas. I like that a lot. If you get the answer right, everybody knows. I mean, it's clear to everybody what the right answer is. And so I didn't have to make any judgment calls about that sort of thing. So I absolutely loved math. I loved Latin because I had never run across a language. Well, I'd studied a little bit of French before that, but Latin was such an eminently reasonable language. I loved studying something that had rules about how it worked and how to conjugate and how to decline and all that sort of thing. I loved it. And I especially loved the fact that when I learned Latin vocabulary, I was learning English vocabulary. So those were the things that I liked most in high school. Went off to college, determined to be a math major. Well, a funny thing happened along the way. My older brother, who was at a different college, my older brother was a philosophy and psychology major. Before I went to college, I asked him to help me fill out my class schedule. I didn't pay any attention to it. I figured he can help out with this. Well, I arrived on campus my freshman year, pulled out my class schedule. Not a math class to be found on my class schedule. I had philosophy 1A, history, psychology 1, and English 1A. I mean, I had all humanities, all classes like that, not a math class or a science class in sight. Well, I just obediently went to my classes, and I went to my Western Civ class. My Western Civ class, I sat down. Now this is the University of California at Santa Barbara. Sat down in a lecture hall with 1,500 other freshmen for the first quarter of our Western Civ class. And the professor came out. This is the professor that I emailed. The professor came out. He was the Roman history professor on in the department. He came out, and the first thing he said was basically something to the effect of, the best thing about studying history is that we find out about ourselves. I had no idea what that meant. That sounded like a bunch of nonsense to me at the time. But he then proceeded to make history the most fascinating subject I had ever studied. He would act out battles. He would do impersonations of important people in history. I mean, he just made history absolutely fascinating. So within a week or so of starting that class, I had completely ditched the idea of being a math major and had decided to become a history major and never looked back after that. But absolutely fascinating course of study. I ended up studying history and religious studies. I had, had two majors. Ended up getting my graduate degree in history at the University of California at Santa Barbara. But during that time, while I loved the academics, I mean, I should tell you about my other freshman class, my fall quarter. That was the history class. I was also enrolled in a philosophy one class. Now, I know it's heretical around here, but I've been known to say that I hate philosophy. Well, that comes from being in philosophy 1A, or philosophy 1, I guess it was, as a freshman, and the professor, Dr. McComber, had no interest in taking us through Greek philosophy. His sole interest, as he was himself a flaming homosexual, his sole interest in class was convincing us that all of the Greeks were homosexual. I mean, that he had an agenda, plain and simple. So reading philosophy, talking about what it meant, we didn't do that. We, day after day, three times a week, basically would sit down and hear his views about his own and others' sexual identity. Kind of lost interest in philosophy at that point. It just didn't grab me. So my only interest in philosophy from that point on would be if I had to talk about a philosopher in studying history. Well, okay, I can do that. But just very, very little exposure to philosophy after that. But then there's another whole area of my life, and that was coming on campus. By that time, I was convinced of my belief in Christianity. Went looking for a Christian group to become a part of. First thing we did Sunday afternoon, first thing I did was I went to a barbecue for Campus Crusade for Christ. My brother had been involved, had some involvement with Campus Crusade, so I thought I'd try that out. Went to Campus Crusade only long enough, just that one barbecue, only long enough to meet my wife. Met her at that barbecue. That was the last I had anything to do with Campus Crusade. Went and found InterVarsity Christian Fellowship. If Campus Crusade's distinctive was training people to do evangelism, InterVarsity's distinctive, if you will, at least on our campus, was taking a more academic, if you will, a more studied approach to Christianity. And I was involved with InterVarsity for the entire time that I was at UC Santa Barbara. One of the critical things that went on with my involvement at UC Santa Barbara, it was an extremely well-organized group. I mean, very, very well-organized chapter. And one of the things that was an important part of the way the chapter ran was they would have older believers work with and disciple younger believers. So my freshman year, literally within a week or two of arriving on campus and getting involved with InterVarsity, the guy who was the president of the chapter, he was a senior, he was the president of the chapter, began to meet weekly with myself and three other freshmen. And I cannot overstate how important that was for me. I mean, that was just huge in my life, because this guy, his name was Gary Fisher. This guy was a tremendously thoughtful believer himself. Very interesting. I was trying to remember, I think that by the time, I can't remember if he was married as a senior, if he got married right after senior year. I think he got married right after senior year. But he was an individual who welcomed us into all different aspects of his life. So I had the chance to see a guy who was consistent about what he believed in every area of his life. We would talk about academic subjects. He was also a history major. We would talk about theological subjects. My recollection was that he was a very good Bible teacher, even at that age. We would talk about relationships. We'd talk about his relationship with his fiancée. He was the first one to encourage me to marry Case when we were freshmen. She of course, didn't know I existed at that time, but we just talked about everything. And that, again, was an important influence for me to see someone who was so diligent about what he believed, who was so diligent at sorting out what was true, and who was so consistent himself personally. It was during my college years that I got exposed to a lot of good Bible teachers. There were a lot of individuals at that time, at that geographical location, that were sort of known to many of us as some of the better Bible teachers. Ray Steadman at PBC was certainly one of them. Another pastor in the Bay Area, Earl Palmer. John MacArthur is still around. He was down Southern California. John Stott, who I think is still alive, was English, but he was known to our generation as a very good Bible teacher. And I began to be exposed to, seek out, and really pursue a lot of those opportunities to hear Bible teachers. And I began myself to become much more intense in my study of the Scriptures. In our university group, we did some interesting creative things with Bible study practices. We had this one program that we would do a couple of times a year where we would take a passage of Scripture. Maybe it was Romans 5 through 8. Maybe it was all of the book of Mark, or maybe one of the shorter epistles, or one of the minor prophets, or something like that. We would take a good-sized chunk of Scripture, and we would go away. I mean, we usually just did it in the classroom at the university, but we'd spend Friday evening and all day Saturday just studying the passage, not using commentaries, not going out and getting a lot of extra biblical aids and helps to have a study. We didn't have study Bibles to speak of in those days. The whole point was, here's the passage. Figure out what it has to say. Spend your time working on it, thinking it through, figure out what it has to say. So we got some tremendous exposure to biblical studies at that time. And I went out of my way to try to seek out those sorts of teachers. Well, then came, I ended up graduating a little bit earlier than I expected to. I looked at my transcript one day, and I only had 13 more units needed to graduate, but I had made a commitment to be a resident assistant in the dorm, so I ended up staying for an additional year, helping out with the university chapter during that time. But during that time, then I was trying to figure out what my next step would be. And I had become convinced by that time that I wanted to be a pastor and a Bible teacher. That was what I wanted to do. So I started looking at seminaries. I looked at Fuller Seminary, Southern California, Trinity Seminary back in Chicago, Dallas. Started looking at Gordon Conwell back east. Looked at a number of different schools, trying to figure out where I would go to school if I wanted to be a Bible teacher. One of the things that, well, I'll get into that in a little bit, but my best friend from college ended up signing up to go to Scribe School. Scribe School, you've heard some of the others talk about. The class that I was in at Scribe School, Bob Blanchard, who lives here in Eugene, was a part of that class. Larry Barber, who you'll hear from in another week or two here, was a part of that class. Ron Julian insists he was not officially a part of the class, but he was a part of the class. I mean, he was very much a part of the class. Jack was one of the teachers at Scribe School. David Crabtree had been at Scribe School a year or two before that. Dave and Kay Smith, who are around this community, had been a part of Scribe School as well. So I ended up going to Scribe School, and let me tell you what was most striking about going to Scribe School. One of the seminaries that I was interested in, that a lot of friends had gone to or thought about going to, still know. Well, it's actually the same seminary that Ray Steadman went to, several of the staff at Peninsula Bible Church went to. That particular seminary, at the time, I don't know if this is true or not still, but at the time, you had to sign a doctrinal statement to get into the seminary, and you had to sign the same doctrinal statement to get out of the seminary, at which point I thought, what's the point of going? I mean, if you have to have your beliefs in place before you go, and you have to have those same beliefs in place when you're done, what happens in between for the 3 years that you're there? Well, I ended up going to Scribe School, and for years afterwards, when people would when I talked about my experience at Scribe School, the overwhelming impression that I had was that at Scribe School, we were not taught what to think; we were taught how to think. I do not ever remember a time that we were at Scribe School that anybody laid down the law for us as to exactly what conclusions we were supposed to come to, exactly what belief system we were supposed to end up with. I just don't remember that happening. Instead, we were given the tools to study the Scripture. We when we got there summer before the main program started, we studied Greek for the summer, then we had second year of Greek our first year, then we studied Hebrew for the summer and the year after that. We would Jack taught a class on biblical interpretation. We had classes on how to teach the Bible. Very interesting set of classes, but at no time do I remember being told what it was we were supposed to think. We were encouraged to understand how to study the Bible, to develop that skill, to work at doing that, to do the hard work necessary to do good interpretation. But other than the grade that Jack gave me on my last paper, at no point were we told what to think. And he didn't even tell me what to think at that point. But just not what you were thinking. That's right. Anything other than that was... But it was just a tremendous experience. And I've got to say, and those of you who are Gutenberg students, those of you who've been around for a while have a good sense of this, even back then when Jack taught, there was always something to listen to because he was not constrained by the interpretations that everybody else gave to the passage. He always brought to the subject matter a fresh look at things, a willingness to consider things that were, consider interpretations and perspectives on it that were not necessarily what everybody else was saying. And for me, that was fascinating. And that actually, I'm gonna go back a little bit, that actually, I think, fits in well with the influences that I felt always shaped my life, whether it was my father's church growing up, where I had the clear idea that he was not constrained by doing things the way everybody else in the denomination did them, or whether it was the other experiences that I had growing up, I always had this sense that there was something about truth that was probably not captured by what everybody else thought. I don't know if I'm even making that clear, but for me, there was just always this sense that that there was something more to, or something other than what everybody was saying that one would find if one was particularly interested in pursuing truth. And for me, that has always stuck with me. That's been a critical part of my intellectual development all the time. I often think in terms of, if everybody thinks one way, well, chances are good that it would be a good idea to look in another direction for what's actually true. Well, just a little bit more about my college experiences there. One of the things that was very important for me during that time was we were going to the University of California at Santa Barbara in the 70s at a time that there was a lot that was in turmoil on college campuses. The gay rights movement was just coming into its own. My philosophy professor was a harbinger of that movement. Black power was beginning to become very prominent on our campus, that sort of thing. So there was just a whole lot of upheaval during those times. And one of the things that, for me, was just a critical event was there was a time when I decided to offer to the student newspaper a couple of articles on homosexuality. Loaded subject at the University of California at Santa Barbara. But my goal, I had two goals when I wrote the articles. One goal was to try to write it in such a way that if, he was dead by this time, but if C.S. Lewis had a chance to read it, he would not have been completely disgusted with the reasoning. I mean, I attempted to, my goal was to be eminently reasonable in what I expressed. And my other goal in writing the article was to never make a reference to the Bible, but to try to develop an argument and develop a discussion of the issues that would reflect what I thought was true and reflect what I thought was true on the basis of my understanding of what the Bible had to say, but not use the Bible as a bludgeon, if you will, to try to beat other people with. So that for me was just a very interesting exercise in trying to figure out, okay, this truth thing, this biblical truth thing, how does it impact other people? How do we communicate that to other people in such a way that they are not turned off simply by virtue of the fact that you're talking about the Bible? How do you communicate truth in other ways? So for me, that was a very, very important thing. And then I'm gonna just sort of jump through to my adult life. A lot of interesting experiences as a young adult after we finished scribe school. My goal, again, was to be a pastor, to be a Bible teacher, but I had this very clear, Case and I made a very clear decision at that time that before doing that, before seeking out a pastoral ministry, a full-time position, I wanted to work in what I thought of as the real world. Before going to work for a church, I wanted to get some experience in the workforce. So I went to Southern California, worked with my older brother for 3 years down there. Lots of interesting ups and downs during that time. That's another subject altogether. But then after that time, 1982, we ended up moving up to Idaho. My college best friend, who had been at scribe school, had gone to Idaho to be on the pastoral staff of a church up in Idaho that was pastored by David Roper, who was one of the other guys that started scribe school. Well, they were looking for somebody who was silly enough to be willing to move up to Stanley, Idaho, which is a little town of 50 people up in the Sawtooth Mountains. They were looking for somebody who would be willing to move up there to pastor a church. Well, after the experiences that we'd had in Southern California, going through a recession, just some horrendous financial experiences, I was happy to do it. If somebody, the way I thought of it at that time was, let me think, if somebody wants to pay me to study and teach the Bible And to live in Stanley, Idaho, that's a pretty good deal. So that's what we did in the summer of 82. Very comical watching us. While we were living in Southern California, we owned a little Fiat 850 Spider, which is it's a convertible that's not much bigger than a motorcycle. We owned this little Fiat 850 Spider while we were in Southern California, sold it to buy a pickup truck to move to Stanley, Idaho. Because in Stanley, Idaho, they are mountain folk up there. So we moved up to Stanley, and over the next couple of years, there were a couple of other experiences that for me were absolutely formative. One was, in Stanley that first summer, I taught through the book of Galatians. And the experience of translating the book of Galatians, studying it for the purpose of attempting, in my own feeble way, to communicate what the book of Galatians had to say to the small handful of people who came to the church, was an unbelievable challenge. It was unbelievably interesting for me to, and the thing that I decided very early on, I'm sure I started thinking about this when I was at scribe school, certainly during that time, the thing that I concluded was that when I was in college, and other college, there were a bunch of guys my own age who would do some of the Bible teaching for our InterVarsity chapter, and almost without exception, they would pull out a book called Vine's Expository Dictionary. They'd look up a couple of Greek words, and then they would base their talk on, but the Greek says, and then they would rattle off what these particular words meant, as though understanding what those words meant unlocked a key to what the passage had to say. Well, the conclusion I came to in scribe school, and the conclusion I came to when I was doing my own translation, was that what knowing a little bit of Greek did for me was it didn't tell me what the passage meant. What it did was it opened up for me all sorts of options about what it might mean. It wasn't that the Greek was a key to, if you just know the vocabulary, and if you just apply these particular rules, well then the decision automatically pops out, as though you could just put it through a computer and come up with an interpretation. Rather, studying it on my own, I found myself saying, wow, this translation says this, and it's possible that it means just exactly that, but it might mean this or this. And for me, that was just eye-opening and unbelievably fun, unbelievably exciting to do that. Then a couple years later, we were down in Boise, and I was on the pastoral staff of this church down in Boise at the time. Had the exact same experience teaching Romans, going through translating Romans verse by verse, line by line, spending just hours and hours, weeks and weeks doing that, and the same experience of just being fascinated by, not by feeling as though all of a sudden, in a simple way, things become clear, but by seeing how the passage would, I'm not even sure how to express it at this point, but basically having that opportunity to study in such a way to see how the argument fell together, to see how the flow of thought fit in, and to see that there was much more to this whole studying, interpretation, thinking, or teaching thing than I had thought in the past. Well, the reason I bring that up is because I would want to encourage each and every one of you, if you have not availed yourself of that opportunity in the past, to avail yourself of that opportunity, not to simply sit and listen to others teach, although part of this community is having some of the best biblical teaching I have seen that I've ever been around. But there is something that is profoundly different and something that is much more important about having each individual study for themselves. And I got to tell you, well, I think, I believe, I hope that others would have the same experience that I had, and that is, once you start doing that sort of thing, it is a fascinating, interesting, stimulating process. So that's my encouragement. Don't content yourself with simply listening to and hearing what others have to say, but avail yourselves of the opportunity to do some study on your own. Well, that brings us, I mean, we can very quickly get up to the present day. We're living over in Boise, Idaho. One of the things, I ended up being involved in some sort of teaching for the entire time that we were in Boise. There was a singles ministry that I was in charge of for a while. After I left the staff of the church, I was still teaching an adult class for several years after that. So I was teaching on a regular basis. And it wasn't at all uncommon for my wife, she loves this story, it wasn't at all uncommon for my wife to come to me sometimes after I taught, and she would say to me, she'd say, "No, has anybody else ever thought what you think about that passage?" Because what I had learned at scribe school was not to be constrained simply by what everybody else had always taught. It was then about 8 years ago that we reconnected with the folks over here. We had sort of lost track of folks over here and what was going on over here. And then when our oldest daughter got ready to go to college, we found out about Gutenberg College from my sister-in-law down in the Bay Area. And my oldest daughter and my other kids ended up attending here. And for us, that has been just a tremendous addition to our life and just a great part of our intellectual journey, because coming over here, we found that we could avail ourselves of, as I said, what I think is some of the best biblical teaching that I'm aware of, and I, over the years, have had exposure to a lot of biblical teaching. But I think as much, or perhaps even more than that, is the way the folks around here are so rigorous about pursuing an understanding of what is true without regard, in a sense, without regard to, well, I guess I'd say the consequences. That is, they aren't going to shape their understanding of what is true by what everybody else thinks. They're willing to pursue it no matter where it leads. As well as, the other thing that to me is just fascinating is, here at Gutenberg College, when you've got a guy that has his PhD in physics. I think, is Chris a physics PhD? And Charlie's philosophy of science? He's a science. I mean, you have all these different people who understand what it means to seek and define truth in a lot of different areas, not just in biblical studies, but to seek and define and understand truth in other areas. So for us, the last several years have just been a fascinating part of the whole journey as we've come to be more a part of things around here. And with that, I'm done. If you have any, if anybody has any quick questions, I can answer a question or two. Otherwise, we're done for the evening. Yes. Oops, sorry. But I can't walk over there with it because I'm tethered.
You mentioned earlier that you wanted your kids to know that you didn't think that certain spiritual practices, traditional spiritual practices, had any bearing on their righteousness. I'm curious about how you came to that conclusion.
Well, I hope it doesn't sound too sanctimonious. I think that I came to that conclusion over the years simply from studying the scriptures and understanding. And let me clarify that a little bit. The habit that I had of having a quiet time was unbelievably influential in my life, in helping me to get a handle on what the scriptures have to say, helping me to understand who God is. So I'm not saying that that there's necessarily something wrong about those sorts of practices, but it all comes down to why we do them. It all comes down to what's the motivation. And we've got a Case, and I have a friend here in town that Case was talking with just recently, who is laboring under this delusion that if in fact she somehow or other was more faithful, and that might be expressed in having her quiet time and praying more, those sorts of things, if somehow or other she was more faithful, she would have a better understanding of what God's will was. She would have a better relationship with her husband. Things would go better with her. And what I concluded from my study of the scriptures is that God acts in our lives quite independently of our efforts. That he doesn't respond to our efforts by doing things in our lives because we're doing certain things. Rather, my understanding of the biblical teaching would be, rather the model is that God in fact works in our lives, changes us, and that the things that we do then flow out of the changes that he's brought about in our lives. It isn't that we do things and he responds to that. Rather, he's the one who is willing and working in our lives, and then our behaviors, our lifestyle, change as a response to that, not something that we do to get his attention or anything like that. Yeah. Any other questions?
I've heard a lot of people in my life claim that there's good biblical teaching in a certain place, and so I want to respect that, but at the same time I can't help but laugh. Mm-hmm. because a lot of people think that they're getting good biblical teaching when they're not. Mm-hmm. So I think I understand what you mean by that, but at the same time, you talked a lot about this community and the good teaching, but I guess this is about the intellectual journey. Mm-hmm. Of the individual, but I guess I didn't really get a feeling of or understanding of the practical, like, everyday realization in this community of truth. Does that make sense?
Not quite. Try me again with the last part.
Okay. You can have all the truth and understanding that you want and intellectual integrity, but if that doesn't change how you interact with people, then what's the point? Mm-hmm. And I guess that's that's what I'm asking.
Okay, I think I understand what you're asking. If I missed it, ask it again. But I think in my experience, there's a difference between those who say this is what the passage has to say, and this is what that must mean in your life. This is what your life needs to look like as a result of what this passage has to say. There's a difference between that and one who says this is what that passage has to say. What are you going to do about it? How are you going to respond to it? Because it's real easy. I mean, when I was growing up, I loved the 10 basic steps to Christian maturity. And I mean, I just love those sorts of things because it fit in nicely and neatly with the order that I liked in things. But what I came to understand over time is Christianity is not a one-size-fits-all sort of thing. I'm not trying to say that there are different truths for different people, but what I am saying is that when God's acting in your life, that's going to look very different from when he's acting in my life. And so it's inappropriate to say, here's what the passage means, and this then determines what Julian should do. It's Julian, right? What Peter should do, what Robbie should do. I mean, this, that's the way the scriptures are often taught, as opposed to this is what the passage has to say. Now, how are you going to respond to that, and what does that mean in your life? Does that make any sense?
I'm not sure. Maybe try me again.
I think what I have come to avoid over time, and when I, let me back up a little bit, when I talk about having been around a lot of what I thought was a lot of good biblical teaching, I was around a lot of the biblical teachers who were widely recognized by the conservative Christian churches that I was most associated with, widely recognized as good teachers. Now, looking back, I don't agree with everything that they had to say or anything like that. And with most of those folks, I don't know that I would have as much issue as I would with other parts of the Christian church that take a very mechanistic view of the Christian life. And that is sort of a, this is what it will look like with every individual. This is how every individual should live their life, and this is what it will mean for them to be faithful, for them to be following God, walking in the Spirit, I mean, whatever phrase you want to give to it. And that's what I've come to the conclusion is misleading, because it just is not, it's just not that cut and dried for each individual. So, and I don't know if this is what you were getting at or not, I think it's important for, use you as an example, it's important for you to have to wrestle with and to have to struggle with the ramifications of what's true on your own. Without me, I mean, I or someone else, some other believer might very well be able to give you some other things to think about, give you some ideas, give you some guidance in certain areas, but it's not for me to tell you exactly what that's going to look like in your life and exactly how that's going to be lived out. That's between you and God, and that's going to vary widely depending on what God's doing in your life. So biblical teaching that's reduced to this is how that looks in your life, or this is how you're supposed to live your life on the basis of that, can be just too simplistic.
Okay, I think I understand that, but I'm not sure if that is really getting at my question.
Okay.
I think maybe what I meant to say was, isn't truth or good biblical teaching, wouldn't that somehow affect lives?
Absolutely.
And if it does, then have you seen that?
Oh yeah, I mean, certainly I've seen that. I've seen that in my own life. I've seen that in the lives of I mean, anybody who is interested in, is open to, is anxious to pursue what the scriptures have to say. You bet. I was going to say, you bet their life is going to be changed. Their life is going to be changed to the degree that that God is in fact at work in their life, changing them. But most likely, the person who has that sort of interest, God's at work in their life, changing them, doing things. And so, yeah, in my experience, the people who are resolutely committed to understand what the scriptures have to say, you bet their lives are changed.
But you've seen people's lives changed under good teaching and bad teaching.
And that's where, I mean, there you get into some very, very confusing scenarios, because some of the folks that I went to college with, who were some of the most committed, sincere, seemingly mature believers at that time, now, 30 years later, are completely off track. So, I mean, who knows? It's when Jesus talks about the Spirit, and it's hard to figure out exactly what the Spirit's doing. That has been true in my experience with the people that I know. I certainly cannot gauge simply from the outside, simply from looking at somebody. I certainly can't gauge whether or not they are in fact growing, maturing. That's something that seems to be proved out over time. Seems to be something that if it's real, it's going to last, and you'll see that 10, 20, 30 years later. Okay? Anybody else? Before we knock off? Well, thank you very much, and if I'll stick around for a couple minutes if anybody else has any questions.